content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Smithsonian Magazine. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll begin with an article from the November 2020 issue of Smithsonian Magazine. From the past is prologue, with an article titled Prime Time by Kovi Biakolo. Thanksgiving's most unexpected legacy is heating up again. In 1925, the Brooklyn-born entrepreneur Clarence Birdseye invented a machine for freezing packaged fish that would revolutionize the storage and preparation of food. Maxon Food Systems of Long Island used Birdseye's technology, the double belt freezer, to sell the first complete frozen dinners to airlines in 1945. But plans to offer those meals in supermarkets were canceled after the death of the company's founder, William L. Maxon. Ultimately, it was the Swanson Company that transformed how Americans ate dinner and lunch, and it all came about, the story goes, because of Thanksgiving turkey. According to the most widely accepted account, a Swanson salesman named Jerry Thomas conceived the company's frozen dinners in late 1953 when he saw that the company had 260 tons of frozen turkey left over after Thanksgiving, sitting in 10 refrigerated railroad cars. The train's refrigeration worked only when the cars were moving, so Swanson had the trains travel back and forth between its Nebraska headquarters and the East Coast until panicked executives could figure out what to do, according to Adweek. Thomas had the idea to add other holiday staples, such as cornbread stuffing and sweet potatoes, and to serve them alongside the bird in frozen partitioned aluminum trays designed to be heated in the oven. Betty Cronin, Swanson's bacteriologist, helped the meal succeed with her research into how to heat the meat and vegetables at the same time while killing foodborne germs. The Swanson Company has offered different accounts of this history. Cronin said that Gilbert and Clark Swanson, sons of company founder Carl Swanson, came up with the idea for their frozen meal on a tray. And Clark Swanson's heirs, in turn, have disputed Thomas's claims that he invented it. Whoever provided the spark, this new American convenience was a commercial triumph. In 1954, the first full year of production, Swanson sold 10 million trays. Banquet Foods and Morton Frozen Foods soon brought out their own offerings, winning over more and more middle-class households across the country. Whereas Maxon had called its frozen airline meals Strato Plates, Swanson introduced America to its TV dinner. Thomas claims to have invented the name at a time when the concept was guaranteed to be lucrative. As millions of white women entered the workforce in the early 1950s, mom was no longer always at home to cook elaborate meals, but now the question of what to eat for dinner had a prepared answer. Some men wrote angry letters to the Swanson Company complaining about the loss of home-cooked meals. For many families, though, TV dinners were just the ticket. Pop them in the oven, and 25 minutes later, you could have a full supper while enjoying the new national pastime, television. In 1950, only 9% of U.S. households had television sets. But by 1955, the number had risen to more than 64%, and by 1960 to more than 87%. Swanson took full advantage of this trend, with TV advertisements that depicted elegant, modern women serving those novel meals to their families or enjoying one themselves. "The best fried chicken I know comes with a TV dinner," Barbara Streisand told The New Yorker in 1962. By the 1970s, competition among the frozen food giants spurred some menu innovation, including some questionable options as Swanson's take on Polynesian-style dinner, which didn't resemble any meal you will see in Polynesia. Tastemakers, of course, sniffed, like the New York Times food critic, who observed in 1977 that TV dinner consumers had no taste. But perhaps that was never the main draw. "In what other way can I get a single serving of turkey, a portion of dressing, and the potatoes, vegetable, and dessert for something like 69 cents? A Shrewsbury, New Jersey newspaper quoted one reader as saying. TV dinners have found another niche audience in dieters who are glad for the built-in portion control. The next big breakthrough came in 1986 with the Campbell Soup Company's invention of microwave-safe trays, which cut meal preparation to mere minutes. Yet the ultimate convenience food was now too convenient for some diners, as one columnist lamented. Progress is wonderful, but I will still miss those steaming, crinkly aluminum TV trays. With restaurants closed during COVID-19, Americans are again snapping up frozen meals, spending nearly 50% more on them in April 2020 over April 2019, says the American Frozen Food Institute. Specialty stores like Williams-Sonoma now stock gourmet TV dinners. IPSA Provisions, a high-end frozen food company launched this past February in New York, specializes in artisanal frozen dishes for a civilized meal any night of the week, a slogan right out of the 1950s. Restaurants from Detroit to Colorado Springs to Los Angeles are offering frozen versions of their dishes for carryout, a practice that some experts predict will continue beyond the pandemic. To many Americans, the TV dinner tastes like nostalgia. To others, it still tastes like the future. Now we'll pop over to an article titled Vintage Takeout by Courtney Sexton. Grab-and-go meals might be all the rage, but the ancients also craved convenience, such as Indian pancakes. These crispy crepes made from fermented rice and lentils are described in Tamil literature as early as the 6th century. Originally a popular South Indian breakfast food, dosas have now become an affordable street food option around the world, often served with a choice of chutneys. When in Rome, snack bars, or popinae, had counters that opened directly onto the streets of ancient Rome, offering ready-to-eat options that included lentils, meats, cheese, green vegetables, fish sauce, and nuts. Aztec savvy. Tamales were a common portable food for warriors and hunters in prehistoric Mesoamerica. News of the delicacy spread after Spanish friars visited Aztec street markets in the 16th century and found vendors stuffing corn husks with rabbit and honey. And finally, British ingenuity. The 4th Earl of Sandwich reportedly slapped meat on bread so he could eat without leaving the card table. The innovation fed his gambling obsession and revolutionized handheld food in the West. Now Americans eat more than 200 million sandwiches a day. Next, we'll move on to another article in the prologue section, National Treasure, Caped Crusaders by John Grinspan. In 1880, zealous children and young adults helped decide the closest popular vote in U.S. history. Abraham Lincoln had called them shrewd wild boys. A British correspondent writing for the London Daily News in the 1870s called them unlike anything with which we are familiar. In the second half of the 19th century, running an American political campaign meant energizing young partisans to march at midnight, wearing capes and waving torches. Politicians on both sides hoped that such youth parades would demonstrate their party's energy and popularity. Though many of these campaigners were too young to vote, they were often the toughest foot soldiers and the most loyal future voters in a system where few partisans ever switch sides. The sight of 30,000 of them pouring through New York's Union Square during elections in the 1880s, or even a few hundred stomping down a small town's main street, was a powerful and persuasive spectacle. Gearing up for the 1880 presidential race, the parties gathered up tens of thousands of youths, Baptist farm boys, Irish immigrant factory hands, freed African Americans, and young girls dressed as the Goddess of Liberty, and gave them their marching orders. Night after night, from now until the 1st of November, our streets will be filled with the bearers of torches and banners, said Philadelphia. The Philadelphia Inquirer reported, youths in capes would decide the future of a noisy democracy. One of those capes was worn by an unknown young Republican in 1880. Some late summer night, a boy or girl donned this red oilcloth garment, tied the white pilgrim collar, lit a torch, and went marching. The slim dimensions of the cape make it likely that the wearer was in his or her early teens, yet they showed up to sing partisan songs or hollering nasty rhymes about the other side. These marchers lived under a constitution much the same as ours, but they pursued political ends in ways that were dramatically different from today's. The cape, then, is as much of a fossil as any dinosaur bone. It's a physical proof hidden in its own past of the forgotten possibilities for young people to shape and reform democracy. Though uniformed young partisans marched in elections from 1860 through 1900, the 1880 race was particularly consequential. It would be the first presidential election since the end of Reconstruction in 1877, after which African American voters faced violent suppression by Southern Democrats and could no longer count on protections from the federal government. One New York Republican warned that 1880 will decide for many years whether the country shall be Republican or Cossack. The end of the Civil War era also left both parties scrambling to recruit run voters, who weren't as invested as their parents in finger-pointing over the war. In 1880, Republicans and Democrats alike claimed to represent a fresh movement, the true party for young Americans. In the struggle for a generation, the Rocky Mountain News said both sides brought up marching capes by the thousands. In November, a 78% voter turnout helped decide the closest popular vote in U.S. history, in which James Garfield, the moderate Republican and former Union general from Ohio, narrowly defeated his rival Winfield Scott Hancock. The youth in the red cape must have celebrated. Michael Campbell, an Irish immigrant factory worker who marched for the Democrats in New Haven, Connecticut, did not. According to his diary, he made a bet on the outcome with his factory foreman and owed him a $1 silk necktie. Young Americans of the era understood that democracy was a nasty game, deeply fraught for black voters, run by crooked machines in many places and often decided by chicanery. The youths who marched in 1880 would help revolutionize this system over the coming decades. William Urin, a young blacksmith in Colorado, marched in 1880. He was incensed by the dirty tricks he saw and took a blacksmith's approach to the problem. Wondering, he later explained to the muckraking journalist Lincoln Steffens, why had we no toolmakers for democracy? Over the next few decades, Urin worked with the National Network of Reformers to hammer out new tools, such as open primaries, referendums, the direct election of senators, and women's suffrage. By 1920, the new democracy they built would have been almost unrecognizable to the cape-wearing youngsters of 1880. Next, we'll move on to an article titled Scotland Yards, text by Peter Ross. A not entirely whimsical trip around Edinburgh to grapple with defining feature of the British landscape. Welcome to Hedgeland. The streets of suburban Britain are edged with merry green. Boxy bushes of privet, beech, holly, yew, and other plant species act as boundaries around gardens, demarcating property lines and separating our domestic and public lives. Town planners call them woody linear features, but they are so much more than that. They are a charm circle drawn around family and self. What the white picket fence is to America, the hedge is to Britain, a cozy symbol of conservatism. The distinctive sound of a British summer, apart from the melancholy hiss of rain, is the insistent growl of the motorized hedge trimmer, the staccato rasp of hand shears. Hearken to those blades. Every snip is a snipe. Mine, not yours. Keep out. On a recent morning, I took a walk through the northern suburbs of Edinburgh, the ancient castle and bristling swoosh of a skyline that makes Scotland's capital so romantic. Could not be seen from here, for I had entered the realm of the hedge. They are so mundane, hedges, as to be almost invisible, yet allow eyes and mind to refocus, and banality yields to fascination. One begins to suspect that hedges are psychological portraits of those who live behind them. A hedge left wild and overgrown suggests a certain lassitude, especially when growing right next to one pruned with geometric rectitude. Outside the home of J.K. Rowling, a towering barrier of Leylandi screens, the 17th-century manor house from the road. Little more than its chimneys and central tower are visible through the green parapet. Cuprecius cyparis Leylandi is the Voldemort of hedges, a sunlight blocker loathed by many unfortunates whose gardens fall in its shadow. It grows 3 feet or more per year. Those with a need for privacy, however, regard Leylandi as the next best thing to an invisibility cloak. On a handsome terrace, a few miles east, an ordinary privet has been transformed into an ocean liner, complete with cresting wave. It is about 8 feet tall from seabed to twin funnels, and nearly as long from bow to stern. It has grown, during the past 39 years, around 3 feet in every direction. This is the work of Edwin Newman, 73, a retired electronics engineer. He's been clipping that ship into shape since he was a youngish man, and his son and daughter were small. My great-great-great-grandfather was one of five brothers, all of whom were master mariners, he tells me. My mother was a wren, a member of the Women's Royal Naval Service during the war. So there's a bit of sea in the blood, he laughs. But mainly, I just thought it would be fun. The Great British Hedge is thought to have its origins in the Bronze Age and perhaps even in the earlier Neolithic period. Hedges were then used to manage cattle, keeping them separate from crops. An archaeological excavation in Cambridgeshire has revealed a sprig of blackthorn, believed to be a hedge remnant dating from around 2000 BC. Management of hedges for agriculture continued under various invading cultures, first the Romans, then the Saxons. The Old English word haga, meaning hedge, is found in legal documents pertaining to land ownerships. Hedges of sufficient thickness and thorniness may even be used as military defenses. Privet is mentioned by Pliny the Elder in his Natural History. Pliny writes that Gaius Matius, a friend of Julius and Augustus Caesar, invented the art of clipping hedges for ornamental rather than strictly pragmatic purposes. Matius also translated the Iliad into Latin, thus doing a favor to both Homer and homeowners. Hedges tend toward anonymity. Unlike trees, those divas forever celebrated for their lofty nobility and sentinel grace, hedges produce few stars, which is not to say there are none. The so-called Phoenix Hedge in the Bristol suburb of Henlees is 290 feet long and made up of several species, including ash, elm, and dog rose. Around 800 years old, it is a survivor. Age in hedges is, however, a slippery concept. They yearn to stretch up and become pure mature trees, but pruning keeps them forever young. A hedge is in a state of suspended animation, says Chris Crowder, head gardener at Levens Hall, a grand manor in Cumbria in the north of England. The individual plants may be ancient and gnarled, but because they have never been allowed to grow in a tree, they never reach old age. No one surely understands hedges more intimately than Crowder. The grounds of Levens Hall are ornamented by the world's oldest topiary, first clipped into phantasmagorical shapes, peacocks and chess pieces, lollipops and lions, in 1694. Crowder is responsible for maintaining about 100 pieces of topiary, as well as a double beech hedge 10 or so feet tall, much the same width, and around half a kilometer long. He's the only the 10th head gardener in all these centuries and lives in the house built for the first, looking out of the foliage that is his inheritance and Sisyphean task. He has had the job for 34 years. It is not clear who is the master, he or the hedges, but Crowder has come to appreciate the long months of pruning as almost a zen experience. What people don't appreciate enough is the simple pleasure of taking time and care to handcraft something, he says. And concentration is very therapeutic. The British urban hedge, as we know it, first flourished between the wars. Suburban, semi-detached houses needed something between and around gardens to mark property. Enter the hedge. Enter, too, almost immediately, the association between hedges and conformity. In George Orwell's novel, Coming Up for Air, George Fatty Bowling looks out one sour morning over a pokey back lawn enclosed by Privet and feels trapped. In the Harry Potter books, the Beasley Dursleys live on Privet Drive, their address shorthand for the small-mindedness of suburbia. In London, during the strangest of years, hedges came to reflect the national mood. In Herne Hill, where the Victorian polymath John Ruskin had, as a child, admired a garden hedge of gooseberry and currant bushes, the letters BLM for Black Lives Matter were sheared into a privet. In Walthamstow, birthplace of the 19th century textile designer William Morris, who once created a topiary dragon from a yew in his garden, another privet became a public statement. Hannah Auerbach George, a weaver in her 20s, took up her trimmer and cut NHS for the National Health Service, Britain's system of free universal health care, into the hedge in front of her house, an expression of solidarity with those on the front line of the battle with the coronavirus. Yet hedges do not always bring people together. This past summer, at my home in Glasgow, I noticed that my neighbor's gardener was cutting the hedge that separates our properties. I had trimmed this only the week before, employing my signature rough and ready style. Now, the gardener was making it flat that one could put billiards on top of it. I sallied forth and questioned his technique. He questioned mine. This was a debate with deep roots. My approach, nature finessed by human artistry, goes back to Lancelot Capability Brown, the landscape architect of the mid-18th century. My neighbor's gardener, favoring a greater formalism, allied himself with André Le Nôtre, the genius of Versailles. He defended this position, not in French, but in vigorous Scots. "You're off your head, crazy, sick!" This was unpleasant, but such conflicts can escalate. In 2003, an argument over a hedge led a man to shoot his neighbor and then take his own life. 2 years later, a man in his 70s was found guilty of urinating under the cover of night on his neighbor's Leilandi, a long-term campaign to kill the hedge that earned him a tabloid nickname, the Midnight Piddler. The neighborhood hedge dispute is a British newspaper staple. The hedge in British culture has a fragile dignity. It is always at risk of being considered a joke, which is unfair. Hedges, explains Tiana Blanusa of the Royal Horticultural Society, are an undervalued form of urban green infrastructure. Her research has found that garden hedges provide an effective filter between our homes and traffic pollution, and they mitigate flooding, reducing noise, and act as wildlife corridors. Hedges are also an admirably versatile metaphor. In Brexit Britain, they are a barrier. In COVID Britain, they are a frontier, this far but no farther. Most of all, in a Britain battered by recent economic and political storms, they are a much-needed hug. Other nations love their hedges too, of course, but only in Britain do they seem so bound up with national identity. The hedge speaks to the romantic idea of the country as a green and pleasant land, but its cheerful dullness undercuts this notion before we get too carried away. Our souls are in those hedges, and those hedges are in our souls. Now we'll move on to an article from SmithsonianMagazine.com. And it's an article titled, Five Ideas to Change Teaching About Thanksgiving in Classrooms and at Home, by Renee Goki. As a mother of elementary-aged children and an Indigenous educator at the National Museum of the American Indian, and now at home, I know that it can be challenging for parents and teachers to sort through books, Pinterest images, I highly suggest you not get your teaching ideas there, and online lessons plans about Native Americans. How do you know what's appropriate, and where can you find more accurate and authentic resources? Added to this good challenge of bringing more Native perspectives to your teaching is the need to move past overused and simplistic curriculums for teaching about Native cultures. One common approach in early elementary classrooms during a Native American unit is to center lesson plans around food, clothing, and shelter, what I call the trilogy approach to learning about Native Americans. These topics seem like simple ways to teach about Native American cultures, but would you want your home to be called a shelter? The word suggests primitive cultures that did not have a complex and sophisticated way of life that varied immensely in diversity. The National Museum of the American Indian has a guide calling The Essential Understandings that provides key concepts and language to frame your thinking about Native Americans before you get started. These specific strategies below build on those concepts to help deepen your teaching and bring more meaningful content about Native Americans to your current education setting, be that a dining room table or classroom. During Native American Heritage Month and throughout the year, food is a great place to start. A worksheet that asks, "What did the Indians eat?" isn't. Instead of a long list of foods, and when we're talking about the Americas, that list is lengthy indeed, with about 60% of the world's foods originating in Native agriculture throughout the Western Hemisphere, explore just one or two foods in depth. Question you might ask yourself begin include, where did a food originate, and how long has it been grown by that specific tribal community? For some cultures, oral traditions say that people come from the food itself, as in this Maya corn story. Make sovereignty a vocabulary word in your classroom. In relation to food, sovereignty is the ability to feed yourself and your family in keeping with your history and culture. Teaching about food sovereignty and understanding how Native food cultures were systematically destroyed gives us several key understandings to American history and to touch points already in the curriculum. Westward expansion, for example, can be explored through Lakota perspectives. Bring Native voices into your teaching. Students can hear Native people's perspectives on their history and experience by reading books and articles by Native authors or listening to programs like the Toasted Sister podcast. share more about the Native people's vibrant ongoing traditions throughout the year by looking at a teaching poster about American Indian perspectives on Thanksgiving. Or you can attend an online program. For teachers, you can go online and attend something from the Museum of Native American History. See Thanksgiving as a chance to share your family's unique history and traditions, too. Talk about the actual 1621 event that's become known as Thanksgiving rather than the mythical one. Did you know that the first Thanksgiving between the Wampanoag and the Pilgrims may have actually had more to do with diplomacy than a simple feast? Honor your students and your own family's food traditions. And think about the traditions you may take for granted. Pumpkin is a traditional Shawnee food. There's a Shawnee pumpkin that some families still grow. It's smaller than most orange pumpkins and a light grayish blue. Pumpkin is called Wapiko in Shawnee. Wapiko Nakawe is a term for the pumpkin dance. Still practiced today, this dance pays tribute to the pumpkin and shows how important it is to the Shawnee people. Some Shawnee families won't carve a pumpkin. Our family doesn't follow that practice, but we don't let any of the pumpkin be wasted. We roast the seeds with olive oil and salt and boil or bake the pieces cut away during the carving for pumpkin bread or pie. Historically, pumpkins were cut into rings and smoked over the fire for winter. Fresh pumpkin can also be cooked by skinning it and boiling it down. It will release its own water, but some water will be needed to be added. All of us have food histories worth exploring. During this year, when so many things look different, take a new perspective on your family's history and traditions through food. Try a family recipe together and have your children write it down to share. Make a short video to send to your family members you can't see in person. Above all, remember to give thanks for each and every day, a gift that is not guaranteed to any of us. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.